Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fit against it, I only wish we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for anything I've done.
This is Rebel Yell, a Southern Nationalist podcast of the alt-right. I'm your host, Masonius Rufus. I'm joined by my co-hosts Ryan McMahon and Macon's Ghost. For this week's episode, we interview the president of the League of the South, Dr. Michael Hill. The League of the South is the premier Southern Nationalist organization dedicated to achieving a free and independent Southern people.
My nom de guerre is Masonius Rufus. Just call me Rufus, please.
Okay, Rufus, I'll do that.
And let me get my other co-hosts in here, and we'll be on our way.
Okay, good deal.
Yes, sir. So
yeah,
I can. Virginia is in the house, and we have Tennessee and Alabama.
Very good.
Cool. Is Ryan going to be joining us today?
Yeah, I'm going to add him right now.
Awesome.
I guess while I'm adding him, I guess we can begin with some preliminaries. I'm Rufus. This is Mencken. And Dr. Hill, you've been at this this game a long time, the game of Southern nationalism, trying to get Southerners to take their own side of an argument.
Over approaching 22 years officially, longer than that, really. So,
yeah. Well, what was it like when you started back in the, you know, I suppose, was that the early 90s?
I put the league together, and we founded it in the summer of 1994. But I had worked a couple of years prior to that, of course, behind the scenes, contacting people to see if they would be interested in throwing in their lot with a Southern Nationalist secessionist organization. So there was a couple of years worth of groundwork that I had to do. So it's been quite a while, but things were very heady back in those days. You know, you enter into something like that with a lot of excitement. It was something that hadn't, the media, it was new to them, and, they covered it with some excitement, I guess you might say, although the American media doesn't know how to cover these kinds of things, almost like children. But it was a very exciting time. We've settled down now after two decades into sort of the grinding work. Everybody thought, well, you know, this will be great. We'll have our freedom in 2 years, and well, we knew that was not going to happen. We knew it was going to be a long grind, and it certainly has been, and it probably will be for quite some time.
Yes, and back then, was it there seems to be like all these different properties. There's the preserving Southern heritage, and then there's like the needs of Southerners today, and then there's the politics versus like the education. It seems like, sure, you have to do a lot of things.
Well, you do, and we wanted to be sort of a multifaceted organization that dealt with all of those things. We wanted to actually be a Southern Nationalist movement. And if you aspire to something like that, you have to deal with all those different areas, politics, education, economics, social issues, cultural issues, etc. And of course that makes it a little bit more difficult because you spread yourself rather thin, but it does give you a lot of opportunities, for action and to formulate opinions on and things such as that, ways to influence people. So it has its good points and bad points, being sort of throwing a wide net, as it were, like that. But, the thing that I knew would happen is, you know, you get something going like this, and it's new, novel, and, everybody's excited about it, and people jump on board, going 90 to nothing, and, in a year or two, they're burned out, and they're gone. I wish we had every member that we've ever had, who would come back and determine that they were going to do whatever it took to make this work. But people are just the way they are. If something doesn't work out when they have their timeline worked out, and if it doesn't work out within that timeline, they're gone off to something else. And I guess that's human nature, and you have to deal with that. But I tried to tell people this is not going to be a short-term ball game that we're playing here. There's no short-term fix to our situation. And, you know, people say, oh, we understand that. Well, some do, some don't. But we've had a cadre of people who have stuck with this, you know, basically from the beginning or nearly from the beginning. And we picked up a lot of good people along the way who have been in, you know, for 5 years, 10 years, 15. So I'm very proud of the people that we have.
Well, they have to be pretty tough, don't they?
Yeah, they really do have to be. They have to be pretty mentally tough because, you know, there are times of great frustration. There are times when it doesn't seem like you're making any progress. There are times it even seems as if you're going backwards, and that does happen. But that's just the nature of any sort of human endeavor. It's not always up and up, you know, on to greater things. And you can tell more about the character of somebody, the way they behave in the bad times, you know, when people are despairing and tempting simply to throw up their hands and run away. Some do, and I guess that's a good thing that you find out that you're dealing with those kind of people, because when things get really tough, that's not the kind of person you want beside you. So this weeding out process, although it does look sometimes like a curse, sometimes I think it can be a blessing too.
Well, tell us about the Black Cross of Southern Nationalism, because I'd say there's a lot of Southerners that don't know what that means.
A couple of our members came up with that design, I guess about 3 years ago or so, three or four. I'd been looking for an emblem specifically for the league for quite some time, I guess I was looking for something a little bit more complicated than I should have been. But when I looked at that black cross on a white background, I said, that's it. That's perfect. Simple. It's got the right meaning. I mean, it's St. Andrew's cross, very easily recognizable as something Southern and Celtic. But I love the color symbolism, too, the white for our people, white folks, and the black cross for no surrender. So it just was perfect. And a lot of people looked at it and said, well, what is this? You know, I recognize the St. Andrew's cross, but what is this? And I had to tell them, look, you know, this is our particular banner. And when we use it in the streets, people are not going to mistake us for the Sons of Confederate Veterans or the Ku Klux Klan or any other group that might use the battle flag. They're going to know right away who it is. It's the league. So we went the first year and a half in our street demonstrations without using anything but that flag and maybe some state flags. But we didn't use any of the other more well-known symbols of the Confederacy, like, of course, the battle flag. And a lot of people didn't like that. They said, you're throwing the battle flag out. Well, I said, no, we're not. We're just seeing how this new emblem of the league resonates with people, and we'll eventually bring the battle flag back in, which we did last year. But I've been very pleased with it because it gives us something that is uniquely ours, something that's recognizable, and something that does have historical meaning, even though some people don't quite see it that way. I do.
Mm-hmm. Well, the St. Andrew's Cross, there's a red one on the Florida state flag and Alabama's, right?
That's correct, yes, and there's a blue one on the Scottish flag. So.
Right, and I think Tennessee went with it turned the battle flag into like a wedding band for the three regions of the state, and Arkansas went with the diamond. So all our states have already, you know, turn the battle flag into the father of all these other state flags in remembrance. And so you just did what, you know, the Southern states have already done, you know, in order, you know, to, you know, use the St. Andrew's cross again, you know, go back into the fray.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, some people really like that, and obviously some didn't. I mean, every time you do something like that, you're going to find your your supporters and your detractors. And I actually had some people quit over it. And I didn't think anybody would take that drastic a measure, but some actually walked away, even though I told them, I said, look, you know, we're not throwing the battle flag out. We're just adding to it.
Mm-hmm.
The battle flag at one time was new. And I told them, I said, look, you know, we need to add some things, to this. So that was what I was concerned about, from the very beginning was, you know, having something that was uniquely our own.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased to see that most people accepted it as we explained it, that it was not meant to replace any of the old historic symbols of the Confederacy or even back before that, but it was simply meant to be an addition to the pantheon, if you will, of our symbols that represent us, and one that would be uniquely the league's, because, you know, we wanted something that would distinguish us. I mean, everybody, you know, wants to distinguish themselves like that.
No, I understand it. It makes sense to me, Dr. Hill. Macon, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I just wondered, Dr. Hill, when you talked about people quitting over it, I was wondering if they tend to be older or younger people in general.
Well, they were both, really. I had some young guys quit over, two or three, that I really hated to see quit. And then I had two or three, maybe four older guys quit over it as well. So it pretty much, you know, spanned the whole age range there. But they all basically said, you know, we don't like this flag. We think it's ugly. We don't think it has any meaning. I said, well, look, you know, somebody has to make the call. I made the call, and that's what we're going to do. And it doesn't mean we're throwing the battle flag out, but, you know, they had already made up their minds. I think people in a situation like that have some other problem going on that they may not want to tell you about, and they're just looking for maybe a reason to leave.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ryan, I haven't heard you speak yet. Are you here, sir?
Yeah. Well, I got two opinions. One, people quitting over the flag. We have like a euphemism for it in our circles. We're autiste, or they're like really, really overly particular about certain things and really committed to those, even if it seems irrelevant. And those are the kind of people that, in the long run, they could hold up operations over, just, I don't say, any kind of other minor annoyance. So if they leave, it's not too much of a loss. Another part is the people who leave due to like burnout. I've had experiences of, you know, other fringe movements before. You might have at best a 10% retention rate, even after a year.
Yeah.
And if they think it's hard now, wait till you have a country. It's going to be a lot harder. I mean, we have to reinvent the wheel in a sense in order to pull this off.
Absolutely. Nobody said it was going to be an easy task. I have people all the time saying, you know, what you're asking people to do here is going to be pretty tough. Well, yeah, it is, but sometimes you have to do tough things. I've had to do things in my life that I look back on them, and I didn't think that at one time I could ever do, and I actually did them. I mean, very tough things mentally and physically and emotionally, and I think people are tough or sometimes tougher than they give themselves credit for being or being able to be. And, you know, we never tried to sugarcoat what we were doing. And I told people from the very beginning that we're not playing. You know, this is real. We're basically throwing out a challenge to the most powerful empire the world has ever seen, and saying that we're going to break away from you. And people just look at you like, you can't do this. Well, yeah, maybe we can't, but we're sure as hell going to try.
Well, Ireland did it. You know.
It's been done, but
I sure did, and I've spent a good deal of time over there back in the early 80s, and I learned a lot of things in my time over there, and I'm trying to apply them here to some degree. There's a lot to learn from that situation.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Well, since I've got you here, did the SPLC, our enemies, did they come up with the word neo-Confederate out of curiosity?
Is that, are they the ones that started that? And what does that mean? I guess I was going to ask you about that word.
It doesn't mean anything to me. I don't acknowledge it. We certainly didn't come up with it. I think it must have been them. I don't know who else would have done it. And I really don't remember the first time I ever saw the term or heard it. But they're the ones who have continued to use it. We never have called ourselves neo-Confederate. In fact, we don't consider ourselves to be Confederates. We're the descendants of Confederates. We believe in the cause of our ancestors, but I've tried to tell people that we have our own cause in our own day, and it may be related, obviously, to the cause of our ancestors, but it's uniquely our own, and we do not call ourselves neo-Confederates for one particular reason, and that is it makes you look like you are living in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that. We've always tried to couch the league as a present and future oriented organization. And, you know, there are other organizations out there that defend the good name of the Confederate soldier and polish gravestones and teach the history of the South, and that's well and good, but that's not us.
Mm-hmm. A bunch of the alt-right are libertarians, and we remember, you know, what happened to the libertarians that went over to defend the South in the 1990s. A lot of them got smeared with this neo-Confederate, you know, label.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the what do you think? Do you think that white genocide, the ethnic cleansing of Southerners, do you think that's the single biggest threat to the South at the moment? It has to be one of the big ones.
Well, yes, I do. I think that the South has been undergoing for quite some time, probably 50 years or so, a campaign of cultural genocide against it. I've always thought that cultural genocide is a prelude, always, to physical genocide. And I have no doubt that there are powers out there that would like to destroy the South, and I don't mean just the culture, I mean the people. They have a visceral hatred of us for some reason. I think it's probably because of our Christian, strong Christian faith and our traditionalism across the board. And we're just a kind of a stumbling block. So yeah, I take that cultural and physical genocide threat very seriously. I'm trying to get Southerners all over to look seriously at it, because if it is as serious as I think it is, people are going to have to do something, and they're going to have to do some things that may be very uncomfortable for them.
No, I in my life I see Latinos that get their licenses suspended and then they just go get a new identity, you know. And then so if you were to take a license from you know, a white man in the South, like, that would hurt him. You know, you've taken his driver's license, but it doesn't hurt a Latino the same way. And there's this outrageous double standard. You know, we probably have millions of people with secret identities, and we're not supposed to talk about it. You know, there's this, this pall of racism, you know, which.
War on noticing.
Yeah. 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 Political correctness is sometimes described as a war on noticing. But, you know, it's outrageous to me. We're going to have cartel violence, you know, a lot of cartel violence in the South in the future. You know,
it's already here.
It's already here, but we're going to have even
California
more.
Here, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, Mr. McMahon's from California. Doctor.
Well, how old are you fellas?
I'm 37.
I'm 37 as well.
I'm 25.
Okay, y'all are still relatively young. I mean, not real young, but not old, certainly. I'm 64. I've seen a good bit, and I know men who are 20 years older than me that I talk to quite often, seen a lot more than I have. But I can tell you this, we're going to see some things in the South and probably in North America in general that would have been hard to imagine, 20 or 30 years ago. Not for me, but for most people, I think. But you're right, there is a double standard, and white folks have got to get tough. I like to I like to quote from Josie Wales. I don't watch many movies, but that was always one of my favorites because there's so many good quotes in it. But, you know, Josie said, sometimes a man's just got to get mad dog mean. And I think that Southerners are going to have to do that. White, but when I say Southerners, let me make it clear, I'm talking about white folks. To us, we're a white organization, and Southerners are white folks. Our kith and kin, our blood, and this is our soil, and we are nationalists, Southern nationalists. So we have no problems with people calling us racist or xenophobes or anti-Semites or whatever. We're used to that. In fact, we encourage other Southerners to get used to it, too, because you're going to have to stand up to your enemies, and sometimes your enemies fall in those groups. So we're going to have to get really mentally tough as Southerners, physically tough, morally and spiritually hardened as well, because I think you're right. Some really tough times are coming.
Yes, sir. This is a podcast of the alt-right, and the alt-right is probably the most amiable the message of white nationalism for the South and for all, you know, people of European descent.
Sure.
So, that's good that we're telling them there's already an organization that is not cucked, so to speak, to use their own term, you know, that will fight for a white nation. You know, for Southerners. Well,
sure.
One of our biggest points, especially when we talk to libertarians, is trying to explain to people is it doesn't matter at this point. You're going to be called racist no matter what you do. So
true.
At this point, you should take your own side, and you should be concerned with the long-term interests of your own people because you're their enemy, and they've already declared war on you as their enemy one way or the other.
Sure.
Another analogy I like to use is, you know, your enemy is like your ex-girlfriend. She says anything she wants to get to you.
Right.
Well, you know, one thing I try not to be is a hypocrite. And I certainly would not claim something for myself or my people that I was not willing to extend to other people. And that's why I say that other groups should be proud of who they are. They should celebrate their culture, their heritage. They should have their own space to live, and it should be theirs. But so should my people. And you know as well as I do that there's a terrible double anti-white double standard out there. You know, it's I think Bob Whitaker, who is an old friend of mine, came up with that the mantra.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, part of that is, you know, Africa for Africans, Asia for Asians, white countries for everybody. You know, that's got to stop. You know, every people has a right to a homeland. And we Southerners, are going to exert our right to our homeland, and we're going to do whatever we have to, and I mean whatever we have to make sure that that becomes a reality, because if we don't have a place to live, if we don't have the resources necessary to make a living for ourselves and to prosper, then we will disappear. So, you know, you can talk about ideas all day long, but this, it comes down to a blood and soil issue. Our people own their ancestral lands as a matter of survival. So that's how serious it is to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot to go on there. Like a lot of us internet trolls, we learned a long time ago that it wasn't about, you know, the issue wasn't the issue. You know, the other side was just trying to humiliate you and get you to kowtow. You know, so you match their insincerity. You fight back. You fight fire with fire. And
sure.
I think that Southerners, it's not just like indifference, it's targeted. Southerners are specifically targeted, you know, for destruction, you know, by the imperial capital up there on the Potomac. And that's just the way I feel about it. That's what I've seen all my life.
Well, I think it's more than feelings. I think that you recognize something.
Culturally, I think we're the one demographic in America, at least in popular culture, that it's acceptable to shit on. If you look in the mainstream media, you look in mainstream movie or fiction, Southern culture, Appalachian culture, and especially, it's acceptable for any demographic in America to make fun of Southern culture.
Sure. And look, that is not something that's new. I remember that when I was a child. I mean, literally a child in the 1950s. So, you know, I became a Southern nationalist at a very young age, seriously. My daddy told me when I was about 6 or 7 years old, he said, boy, the wrong side won that war and we're going to pay for it. We are paying for it. So I never had any illusions of being an American nationalist or an American patriot or anything like that. And I've seen this for most of my lifetime. It's real.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's, if no one else has any other questions, we can move on to, you know, talking about, you know, another issue like, you know, family, you know, the importance of family. I know you've written a lot about the clannishness of Southerners, and the alt-right has done a lot of studying up on this. I'm thinking specifically of a blogger named HBD Chick and such. But Southerners are more clannish and more family-oriented than the deracinated Northerners. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think part of it is the fact that most Southerners can trace their descent back to Scotland, Ireland, Wales, the Celtic fringe areas of Europe, where this sort of rural clannishness was a way of life. I mean, that was the local government.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have cities. You didn't even have towns in some cases, you know, maybe little market towns. But the government, and, you know, this I'm not talking about, you know, 1,000 years ago. I'm talking about, in some ways, as late as the 18th century, when the population shift was going on, Scots and Irish and Welsh and all were coming to North America. Their local governments were extended families. Clan chiefs sort of took the place of the executive, I guess you might say, and that was simply the way that things were run on a local level, and they transported that system with them into the frontier regions of the South, and we still have that clannishness, that family orientation with us today. It's very important to Southerners, and we get, you know, made fun of worshiping our ancestors and things like that. Yes, there is a little bit of truth in that, but you know, a man's got to know where he comes from. I think he takes pride in that and learns from it. It's a thread of continuity that keeps him grounded, keeps him from being, as you said, deracinated and just blown about by, you know, the winds one direction and another. And that's the way big intrusive government likes it, is when people are deracinated. They have no roots, and they can simply be pushed around as an individual. We have people we can go to, you know.
An alternative, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, you mess with me, I got family that'll come after you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that I'm not the only Southerner that can say that. And that maybe that's why we leave each other alone, is we know that I've got, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles and you know, brothers-in-law and all that'll you know, come set things right with you if you bother me.
Well, that's why we're
polite. I love that yeah. Kind of world.
Yeah, and that's where Southern politeness comes from.
You know, believe it.
Yeah, you can't run your mouth, you know, without paying the toll. So.
No, that's true. I can remember being in London, I guess back in the early 80s, and I was sitting in a cab, and the cab driver has been raining, and he ran through some water and splashed a guy standing there on the side of the street. And man, they got in this shouting match with one another. And when it was over, the cabbie rolled up his window and and drove on. I said, you know, back where I come from, one of you sons of bitches would be dead by now. He says, what are you talking about? I said, we don't talk to each other where I live like that without somebody getting shot or cut.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I said, he went on about us not being civilized. I said, no, sir, we are very civilized. And that's the glue of our civilization right there. It keeps us polite. We don't dare run our mouths like you loudmouth, you know, yeah. Brits here.
Yeah, they've been depoled, you know, to like pinned up animals or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we used to be able to duel. That's why they were polite, you know, stereotypically back in the day. Of course, now you can't even have a butter knife. So you can put your mouth.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, well, you know, we weren't able to, when I was a kid, or say a kid, when I was a teenager and young man, we were not able to duel. But I tell you what we did. We squared off and settled it with our fists. And nobody called the cops. And nobody got their butts whipped when they got home by their daddies. Or the principal didn't call you and suspend you from school. They realized it was two young men settling a difference the way it was socially acceptable to do so. Nobody got killed, nobody got cut, nobody got shot, but somebody got the shit beat out of them.
That's just honor, yeah. Yeah, and it wasn't gangbanger violence where someone gets killed, you know.
No, and it was one-on-one, too. It was not like three or four people on one person, you know, knocking them down and kicking them in the head or something. It was a fair one-on-one fight.
More importantly,
we settled
too,
things like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, more importantly, I mean, some people who haven't been in that environment may not understand is, yeah, things actually also got solved, too. I mean, because we had that violence, we actually solved the problem, and we actually created a situation where we can resolve those issues by having the conflict go.
There's actually a book about it.
Oh, yeah, Southern Honor. Was it The Culture of Southern Honor or something like that?
Honor by, I looked it up, Richard Nesbitt and Dove Cohen. Or they did something called the asshole test, where they'd, you know, have Southerners, they'd go to a building, they'd tell them there's going to be this, you know, social experiment there. In reality, one of the test takers would bump into you on the sidewalk and then, like, just insult you, and they'd see what Southern men would do versus, you know, like, men in New York City. And the men in New York City would kind of just, like, shrug it off or apologize, or Southern men said, hey, you got a problem?
Right, want to resolve the issue.
Yeah, I read that study, and I wrote an article for Chronicles Magazine about it that was published back in the, I guess, mid-90s. It's called Violence, Honor, and Civilization. I've still got it. I think I posted it on the League website sometime last year. But, yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, our sense of honor, you know, compels us to settle things like that. But I tell you what, when you had a fair fight with somebody like that, you didn't have to watch your back, because you knew that they weren't going to, if you beat them, you knew that they weren't going to backstab you somewhere if it was a fair fight.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, you fight once with a guy like that, and usually if it's done fairly, you're
friends
for life.
Yeah, you're friends.
They have a beer afterward.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I don't know if you've heard of Kurt Doolittle. He's a libertarian philosopher. He has a concept about it called a distributed violence, where if you maintain limited government, if you make every man responsible for enforcing social norms. And that's kind of like the example. There's you don't outsource the violence to the state and then like the law enforcement and they have to call them. You know, you just handle it yourself and you have a limited government. It's a lot cheaper and a lot freer.
Now you're getting to the, you know, a crux of an issue here, because we're not allowed, you know, to live without our betters up there in Washington, right? They need to solve all our problems.
That's right.
Right. So like every intermediate institution, whether it's the family or local sovereignty or state sovereignty, has to be overcome. For Washington and that managerial class that rules it.
That's where anarcho-tyranny kind of comes in, because there's a minimum threshold for state intervention. The more bloated and inefficient the institutions become, the less likely they are to respond to the minor things, like, you know, someone bumping into you onto the street, or at least in my case, I used to manage a store in a majority black neighborhood, and there was just constant theft, constant, you know, threats of violence, and, you know, like, I can't beat them up. I'd be fired instantly if I call the cops. They come 2 hours later. They don't remember any details. I told them on the phone. They don't care. So like, what do you do? I'm pretty sure it wouldn't happen in an honor culture. I could defend myself appropriately.
Mm-hmm. I think,
well, I think one of the goals of the central state is to destroy all those intermediate institutions that separate the individual from the naked raw power of the state. And I think you mentioned, you know, family, you know, in the medieval age, you had the guild system, and you had all these intermediate institutions, the church, and they protect individuals from the raw power of the state. And what the state wants is to destroy those, of course, and then monopolize the means of violence.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we're like interchangeable parts, you know, for the managerial class, you know. So I go betray my ancestral homelands to go get a good job, you know, working in corporate America somewhere else, you know.
And if you do that, you do have to sort of forswear your raising if you're a Southerner.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make a choice. You know, you can't be a Southerner and be a cog in corporate America.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Who's going to take care of the graveyard?
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, this whole idea of you know, having to call the cops every time that there's a problem is just playing right into the hands of the centralizers, because they do want to monopolize violence. And if they were able to do what they wanted to, they would disarm you, and you would be completely dependent upon them for everything. I can remember when I was a child, I had a rifle by the time I was 7 years old, and had really learned to be quite a good shot by the time I was about 10. And we lived out in the country. And one day we had a storm shelter there under the front porch. And this guy came stumbling down the dirt road and crawled up in there into the storm cellar. My mama saw him coming and called me inside and everything. Well, she was all panicked and all. So what I did is I went in and got my .22 single-shot rifle, picked up a couple of cherry bombs. I don't know if y'all know what those are.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to have those, you know, as a kid. You know, we could blow a lot of things up with those things. I got me a couple of cherry bombs, a box of matches, and my rifle. Went out there, and the guy was drunk, you know. He was just looking for a place to sleep off his drunk. So I was going to be the soldier. So I opened up the door to the cellar, threw the cherry bombs in, shut the door, let him go off. He comes stumbling out, probably half deaf, in a, you know, a smoke trailing all around him. And I stick the gun in his back. I'm 10 years old. This dude's probably 50. And my mama called the sheriff, and the sheriff came, and my daddy came, and they both patted me on the head and said, "Boy, you did good. You did good." What do you think they'd do today?
Oh, gosh, they might take you away from your parents.
CPS would take you. Yeah. You'd be in juvenile hall. You know, your parents would go to jail for letting, you know, inappropriate storage of firearms if you just, like, parked this all up and down. And that drunk guy would sue your family.
You kind of see why I don't like this modern world. I grew up in a time that was absolutely completely different.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a better time, frankly.
Well, I think it was. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but it was certainly better than what we have now. I have grandsons. I have three grandsons and a granddaughter right now, and I'm really teaching particularly the grandsons how to be young men. And, you know, I think they're going to have a hard time in this world either way they go, because if they learn how to be young men, they're going to run up against all these social approbations that tell them, oh, you can't do that, you can't do that. But if they don't learn to be young men, they're going to be pushed all over the place and maybe eradicated. So it's not easy either way.
Do you guys have anything to add there?
I was just going to say, I thought it was funny that at a 10-year-old, you could figure out how to room clear, like a SWAT member or something, and just chuck in some flashbangs and put a gun at him.
Listen, that's all I did when I was a boy, is play army of some sort. I played outside. I didn't have anything to do inside except read, which I loved to do, but I read at night, and, you know, when it was too bad to play outside. But otherwise, I was outside either later on playing sports, or when I was younger, I loved to play Army, and I learned a lot as a child because my daddy was a soldier and he taught me a lot. And, man, that was just right up my alley.
To this day, Southerners sign up en masse, you know, for the military. A couple of
absolutely.
Us are vets. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's too bad that they have to go off and serve the military that invaded their ancestors 150 years ago.
Well, maybe they can put it to good use by getting their freedom with it.
Well, I always tell young guys, I said, if you're dead set on going into Uncle Sam's military, I want you to understand one thing. The main thing you need to do is get some skills and then come back out here and serve your people.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree.
They have gangs do it. They got MS-13 in the Army now, so they use that for the streets.
Oh, you probably saw that story of the poor kid that got a rebel flag tattooed on him, and it said heritage, not hate. And he couldn't join the Marine Corps.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
His tattoo basically said, I'm not a racist, and that wasn't good enough.
You're right, right, because that's what heritage, not hate means. It means, you know, oh, no, you know, I'm not a racist, you know.
Yeah. Well, we got to scrap that phrase. It's just, it leaves you
open. I hate it. I absolutely detest it.
Yeah.
If anybody uses it within sight, within arm's reach of me, I'll slap the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're the same way. We learned that, you know, that's cucked. You know, that's, you know, that's the wrong way to be. Cause it's the premise. You're accepting the premise of the person that hates you.
That's right.
Yeah. You're asking permission to be an identity. Like, you can't. You just have to say, like, screw you. I'm doing this anyway. Call me what you want. Yeah. You're my enemy. I'm worried about insults to my friends, not you.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my answer, my recommendation, rather, to people who get all these epithets thrown at them, you know, racist, homophobe, anti-Semite, whatever, just look at the people who are throwing them at you and say, what's your point? what's your point? So what? Okay.
Right.
You know, and then just go about your business. It leaves them, you know, it makes them walk away mumbling with their head down. They don't know how to deal with it.
Because all they have is shame.
That's right. And if you won't go curl up in the corner in the fetal position and beg for forgiveness, man, they don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. Which I thought brought up a really good a point that an alt-rightist that I like, Master Chim, Justin Garcia, he's out of New York, but he's actually said some really favorable things towards Southern nationalists, was that the need for young men to actually find themselves in jobs and professions where they can actually afford to have that kind of independent attitude, where they don't have to be complacent in a corporate environment, which is the biggest problem for a lot of people in their 20s and 30s right now.
That's true. We encourage our young folks, particularly young men in the league, to develop a skill or a trade that will allow them to work independently. Now, you may have to work for somebody for a while to, you know, sock away the money to go out on your own, but that should be the goal. So you can be who you are, and you don't have to kowtow to anybody and, you know, play like you're something you're not. I agree with that. It's a great thing to tell young folks.
Well, a lot of the theories converge on that point, you know, because it would also be good to avoid the college and the college debt. You know, and we want men to be making money, earlier on in their lives so they can get married and have babies.
Yeah.
And, sure.
You know, so everything seems to converge on that point. It's like, you know, get a trade.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I taught history at the University of Alabama and another place for about 20 years. But you know, that was a different time. I wouldn't recommend that white folks, particularly white males, waste their time with college or university today. I'd go out and learn a trade like gunsmithing or welding or plumbing or carpentry or something like that that was useful. And you can make a good living doing something like that. And you also don't get yourself in debt for, you know, 4 years of college or more.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, you start raising a family earlier, and I think that's good advice.
Right. If everyone has the same number of children, but you just get married earlier and have them sooner, that raises the population by itself.
Sure it does.
Yeah, just mathematics. Yeah. Well, we've talked about, what about Christianity? You know, because that seems to be an issue on the alt-right where some people don't like traditional religion because they think it's the problem. And they want to, you know, go with some sort of neo-paganism or, you know, they're you know, atheists and they don't want to be. Yeah. But Southerners are traditionally very religious.
Yeah, we, you know, we're not called the Bible Belt down here for nothing. And I think that's one reason that we're in the crosshairs, as it were, of the people who would like to destroy us, because they realize that we are the last outpost of what used to be known as Christendom, which used to be, of course, centered in Europe, but Europe has pretty much given it up today. And the South is the last vestige of that. I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian. I was raised in a Christian home. I can't say that I always have adhered to Christianity. I went through a part of my life when I was a teenager and into my 20s now where I was nothing but a hedonist. But I never forgot my raisin, as they say. And I came back to the faith when I was probably in my early 40s. And I've been a Reformed Christian for a little over 20 years, I guess. I'm a traditionalist. I'm sort of an old-fashioned Christian. I'm not one of these new I don't even know how to characterize it, sort of conservative Christians. I think you know what I mean. Consequentially, from that, I've found it very hard to find a church. In fact, I've just left the one that I've been a member of now for about the last 3 years because I just can't tolerate their positions anymore. So I don't have a church. I guess I'll be a home churcher, as it were. But I do think that Christianity is very important. It keeps a man grounded. It keeps a man looking at transcendent things away from himself. And I just think it's very important. We don't have any sort of religious litmus test or test oath, whatever you want to call it, for membership in the league. But most of us are Christians, but we have atheists, we have Odinists, heathens, whatever you want to call them. But we're predominantly Christian, and our worldview is based on old-fashioned Christianity. Now, I wouldn't give you a plug nickel for what they call Christianity in most churches today, because it isn't. It's a false gospel. And
yeah,
it's
those
very dangerous.
Mega churches with the you wear your blue jeans and you eat your coffee and yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you wouldn't catch me around one of those places and
progressivism,
you know,
choir.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know how y'all feel about this, but most of these modern churches like that are Zionist, full of Christian Zionists.
The Jew worship in death cults, basically.
Yeah, dispensationalists.
Dispensationalists, Christian Zionists who believe that the modern secular state of Israel has some special dispensation from God.
Well, they're heretics.
The Jews are the chosen people. You know, on and on.
The church is supposed to be Israel, the Christian church, that is. So.
I know, but you get a lot of Christians have a hard time getting them to accept that.
Yeah, and the theology, I mean, that category, I mean, Americans suddenly seem to think that somehow that is Christianity in toto when that's a theology that's maybe 150 years old and only a small fraction of Christianity.
Yeah, it's probably pushing it to say it's 150 years old, but yeah. I get your point. It's very recent.
It's not historic. Right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm from the Calvinist background, and it seems like Southern Calvinists are completely different from the Calvinists of New England. I'm just throwing that
out.
We
are.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm a Calvinist. I've been a Presbyterian now for the last 22 years or so. An old hardcore Robert Louis Dabney, James Henley Thornwell type Southern Presbyterian.
Have you ever noticed how many of us are? I mean, like,
yeah, I know, absolutely.
Jared Taylor, Sam Dixon, Sam Francis, you know, the list goes on and on of Southern Calvinists that fight the good fight.
That's right, and it's completely different from Northern Puritanism.
Yeah.
I wonder what the difference was. I mean, that's a research paper right there.
Well, you know, I can tell you just from a general point of view, the Puritans in New England just apostatized very quickly because they got into Unitarianism and, you know, everything that springs from that, and it became a very unbiblical, messianic religion. And you can see it, you know, by the 1820s and 30s begin to manifest itself, and bring about some of the ideas that led to war. And it was a religious war. I don't know if you've read that old quote by James Henry Thornwell where he sums up the sides as nicely as anybody I've ever seen. He said, you know, on the one side you've got, you know, red Republicans and, socialist and, you know, feminist and all, you know, everybody that's on the wrong side. And on the other side, you know, you've got Christians, mainly, you know, Southern, Calvinists, because there was a streak of Calvinism in the South, not just in Presbyterianism, but in Baptist faith, even the Methodist faith, in the antebellum period. So Thornwell summed it up very, very well by saying, you know, it's Bible-believing Christians in the South versus apostatized red radicals in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the descendants of Puritans.
Well, the Christians in the North had that, you know, heaven on earth kind of, you know, we're going to make Israel and North America thing. And as it became more secular, they kept the heaven on earth brotherhood of man rhetoric. But, you know, the brotherhood of man is now under a red banner and a hammer and sickle. Instead of a cross.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I think that one of the things that drove them was the fact that far from seeing man's problem as an internal heart problem, you know, that all men are you know, have dark hearts and are sinners, they viewed man as, all, you know, reformable, and that all the problems were external. So they meddle in every social area to try to create a utopia. Whereas Southerners realize you can't create utopia because man's heart is dark and always will be dark.
Yeah.
So why try, you know? Let's just learn to live with the fact that we can't perfect society.
I think you're right. I think it's that total depravity inoculates you against a lot of this nonsense.
Yeah, it's a good inoculation against trying to perfect society and create utopias, which always leads to guillotines and, you know, bullets to the head, gulags, whatever.
Yeah, they're so nice, these utopians.
Yeah. I was not to derail, but I always thought that was always sort of a unique thing you see sort of in the South, but you also, I guess, parts of Britain as well, just that Anglo-Celtic tradition where you have, you know, rightists. Because of that Calvinist tradition, they're sort of hands off. They understand that you can't impose something on the human soul, that you plead to almost sort of a libertarian tradition, not out of necessarily a desire to have human liberty, just because, but, you know, sort of a recognition of human nature. You can't force somebody to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a recognition of the biblical truth about the condition of mankind, the permanent condition of mankind. As long as, you know, in the temporal sense, man will never be perfectible on this earth. And when you recognize that, you're not susceptible to every, you know, fad that comes down the pike. I mean, you look at all the fads that took place in the North, say from 1789 to 1850.
Yeah, the burnover.
You have
mystery.
All these just weird feminist, health food kicks, communitarian living. I mean, everything. I mean, you might
free
say
love.
That, you know, sort of the, free love movement, all that kind of stuff. The hippie movement started long before the 1960s, apparently. So.
Oh, yeah. Oneida and its stirpa culture. You're right. I forgot that there was some pre-birth control pill people like that. Yeah.
And you didn't see any of that in the South. If you did see something like that in the South, it was because somebody moved down here and brought it with them. It was not it was not native to the South.
Yeah, we got him. There he is.
Yep.
Yeah, we got an infiltrator.
I found out, like, I've done some research, you know, about the refugee resettlement programs that are going on in, here in the States, going on since, like, the 90s. They use churches, and it seems like, you know, Minnesota is, like the number one recipient of Somalis, and they go through the churches down there. They give them, like, you know, we need a sponsor, and so they get federal grant money to sponsor refugees, quote-unquote, and, like, you know, they got, like, 20,000 Somalis in, you know, Minnesota. They even have them, like, all over the Great Lakes area. We're trying to get them in Montana now. And it seems like these, you know, corrupted churches are the ones that are the spearhead of this. It's like, oh, this is a Christian thing to do, is to, you know, adopt, like, every African you can, or, like, unnaturally extend whatever empathy you have to total strangers that would probably, you know, cut your head off given a chance.
Well, apostasy is a devilish thing. And this is what it leads to. I mean, you know, they are being paid by government money to basically betray their own people and destroy their own culture and civilization. And they've, you know, taken it hook, line, and sinker, as they say.
Well,
these people have lined themselves up as the enemy. I mean, there's no doubt about that. They should be dealt with.
Isn't that deeply ironic, though? I mean, if they were trying to teach them abstinence or spread the gospel, that would be a problem, right?
Yeah.
If they were actually trying to do something positive, you know, you can doubt that they wouldn't have any government support for it.
Or if, I mean, even if they did the simplest thing, which was just limit support to those Christians in the region, you know, the few Christians in the region, that alone would be seen as, you know, totally unacceptable.
Oh, absolutely it would. I mean, we know what we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
So... I don't know. You know, there are churches in the South that are doing this, too. The Lutheran Church is doing it in South Carolina.
Yeah.
We've done some research to find out who's doing it over there to bring in Middle Easterners, Muslims, into upcountry South Carolina. And it's the Lutheran Church who's doing it.
Right, and that was supposed to be the Dominionist state, right? That's where they were all supposed to move to.
Yeah, right.
Right, they're going to bring in radical Islam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Germans are not guilt for some reason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny how theology parallels, like, you know, your family patterns. That's interesting. That's a whole other topic. But I guess since we're coming into the end part here, what about what do you think about Donald Trump, the phenomena of Donald Trump?
Well, I think he's very interesting. Obviously, we don't, in the league, we don't endorse any national candidates, being a secessionist organization. We try to limit our participation politically to the state and local level. But obviously, we do watch what's going on in national politics, particularly presidential politics, with a great deal of interest, because obviously it's going to have an impact on a lot of things. Trump is interesting. I've done a lot of interviews, not only with American media, but European media over the last several months about Trump. And I've said, well, you know, we don't endorse anybody. We don't support anybody. But probably quite a few of our members as individuals will be voting for him. And they said, well, why? I said, well, because Donald Trump has the ability, first of all, to destroy the mainstream Republican Party, which we've been trying to urge people to do for 20 years. The Republicans are no friend of the South, never have been. And I'd love to see the damn Republican Party destroyed. And Donald Trump may be able to do that. Secondly, it would cause political chaos. And the more chaos, the better for a group like ours. But thirdly, he does address some very important issues, immigration, of course, being one, but overall he addresses this kind of all-pervasiveness of political correctness. And I think a lot of people are supporting him because, A, they don't see him as being beholden to any big money group, and secondly, they're sick of political correctness, and they like it when somebody will come out and skewer all these sacred cows, like Trump is willing to do. I mean, he's a loud mouth. I don't trust him any farther than I could throw him, as my daddy used to say. I don't think he's a friend of the South, but he is interesting to watch for those reasons I just mentioned, the chaos factor in particular.
Yeah, he doesn't back down. He bullies the bullies, and that's and then the immigration, bringing that into the Overton window. We were never supposed to talk about that this past year.
Yeah. You know what's funny? It was John McCain was saying basically the same thing in 08 about, like, well, not building a wall but a fence. And that was, like, he was, like, the moderate mainstream, and that was, you know, his selling point. Now you're basically Hitler if you want a fence. So, like, it just highlights a radical shift. And not even 10 years, and, like, all of these establishment people, either they're in on it or they're just completely just oblivious stooges that just go with the flow and don't know how to actually be aggressive and force their ideology on society.
Either in on it.
Yeah. You know, the thing, I just love
it. The ones on top are in on it. You know, the average guy on the street, it's like they're just oblivious, I think.
Yeah, the average guy on the street's pretty much oblivious. But, you know, I think things like when Trump says, yeah, we're going to have a wall on the southern border, and Mexico's going to pay for it. I think that just, there's a certain class of people out there who just says, I've never heard anything like this from a politician. And it's attractive to them because they're used to weasels, you know.
Yeah.
You know, speaking and certainly acting against their interests, like John McCain, as you brought up. And here's
right,
Trump saying, look, we're going to build this wall, and we're not going to pay for it. We're not going to ask you taxpayers to pay for it. We're going to make the damn Mexican sons of bitches pay for it.
Well, what's funny is we can. We can, because they make more money off of wire transfers from their invaders in our country than they make off of petroleum.
Of course,
yeah, Western Union gets like billions a year just from like that institution alone.
Yeah, I bet we know who Western Union won't be supporting.
Yeah.
But you know, Trump has really tapped into to a nerve, as it were, here. And you know, I at one time I said, the GOP will never let this guy near their nomination. And if he gets it, the establishment won't let him near anywhere near the White House. And that still may be true, but I think he's a lot more serious candidate now than people thought he was maybe 6 months ago.
Yeah, there's something about the media. They should have shut him out a long time ago, but they kept pointing and sputtering, you know, to have like this 2-minute hate that we're all supposed to have, and it backfired, and it keeps backfiring.
They were making money off of him until they decided they hated him a week later. So.
Yeah, I mean, you can't let something grow past a certain size and then expect to get rid of it without ramifications.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the homeschooling movement.
Yeah.
If it was going to be crushed, it should have been crushed in its cradle. It's too big to crush now without serious repercussions for the state.
Yeah.
And the same for gun ownership.
Yeah.
And the same maybe in a shorter term scale for Trump. I mean, if they were going to crush him as a candidate, they should have done it months ago. He's too big to crush now.
It's like that line from Lenin, you know, the capitalists to sell us the rope, we used to hang him. You know, the media gave him the attention he needed to be popular. If they left him off of that, like, Mexican rapist comment, they'd have been like, oh, he's a goofball, don't talk to him. They could have done it then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they couldn't help themselves. I guess it was important to have that 2 minutes of hate we were supposed to have or whatever.
I don't think
that worked out too well
for the
establishment.
Part of it.
But look, what happens, for example, if the Republican Party establishment tries to shut Trump out of the nomination? They're going to destroy themselves if they do that.
Yes, sir, they sure will.
I would not be surprised if they didn't do that. I think when Sam Francis called them the stupid party, he was absolutely correct.
Well, I just read an article today about how all the Beltway election people, they basically been scamming Ben Carson, you know, just living off of that money. And I guess Ben Carson and his supporters, you know, they were the dupes, you know. And if they were really smart, they wouldn't let, you know, the two Hispanics go loggerheads. They would have put everything on one or the other.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
So, You know, so yeah, the party is too busy, molesting us to realize that they're digging their own grave.
Yeah.
Well, I hope they dig it deep. I hope it gets filled in with a lot of damn dirt.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I used to work in the party, and it's one of those things where I know they have plans. They changed the rules back when Ron Paul was trying to run in 2012. He's going to need to get 51% and 8 primary states. That's like this new little thing they threw in there. So far, he's polling in the 40s, but the latest he got was 46 in Nevada. If he gets 51% and only 7 of them, they can have a broker convention, and then the superdelegates get to pick who's going to be the president. So that's probably how we're going to do them in. If we're going to do it in the worst, most like dirty way possible, that's kind of how I want it to go. Like, I want them to just be screwed out so the Republican Party basically just hangs itself in public, and then we can just chuck it and get something new.
Yeah. Well, imagine this scenario. Let's say that Trump just is unstoppable at the Republican convention, and he gets the nomination. There's no way that they can, do any dirty deals behind his back. And he is the Republican candidate, and he is a big, big threat to win the election in November. Do you think that the establishment would go as far as assassinating him?
Oh, I've thought about it, and a lot of my friends have talked about that.
I don't think they'd kill him. I mean, they might because they're dumb, but if he gets into presidency, he's going to control the IRS. That's what they're afraid of.
There's going to be a lot of stuff that he could mess up.
The Justice Department, like every liberal and conservative, someone's doing drugs, screwing children, not paying taxes, is all these little shell games. That's why Sheldon Adelson's throwing his money behind Rubio because you know what he's doing on the side.
I think a lot of people are concerned that Trump potentially may have the kind of vindictive streak that somebody like LBJ had. Not necessarily because he's somebody who plays inside politics, but he's the kind of person who is not going to allow people who have fought against him the entire way up to remain around to take him down.
Well, I think it's perfectly possible, personally. If we're talking about assassination, that he might just end up assassinated. So,
but a good assassination wouldn't look like an assassination. So, he's 70 something. He could possibly have a quote unquote heart attack at any time.
Thanks, Scalia.
Well, at least he can afford his own security, right? So that's
true.
He does have helps. Secret Service right now. I know just from contacts. I know working events. As of Nevada, he does have Secret Service providing security for him. At least that's what I was told there.
Hopefully he doesn't trust them completely.
Yeah.
We're the best, you know that.
Yeah.
Well, fellas, it's going to be, if nothing else, it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
To watch.
Yeah. I'm just here for
the ride. I haven't seen anything like this in my lifetime before. I guess the closest I've seen to it maybe was the George Wallace phenomenon. Back in the late 60s, early 70s. And of course, you know what happened to Wallace.
Yes, sir.
And I remember very well when that happened. I was already almost 30 years old. Almost 20 years old when that happened. I remember it well. But, you challenge the wrong people in American politics and you can pay for it with your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's real. That's not a conspiracy.
It's real.
Theory.
You better
real.
Believe it's real.
Yeah, because, good Lord, even Ross Perot, didn't he have his family kidnapped or something? There was something weird there that happened to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, he's had financial tax issues.
Yeah, you're not supposed to have an outsider come in.
That's right. Outsiders are not allowed to, I've got to go in just a second, so maybe this will be the last thing I say, but, the American people are, they believe in democracy, generally. I don't. I think it's a terrible system. But do you really think that the powers that be are going to trust the American electorate to make a decision that determines whether they keep or lose their wealth, power, and position?
No, why would they?
Do you think that the powers that be in this country and in any country, because it's really a sort of a global network of these people, are going to trust their future to the democratic process?
No, of course not.
Not no, but hell no.
Yeah, of course not. That's not even, you know, of course.
Hillary, I'm jaded enough at my age to have seen, you know, seen a lot. And I've learned that these people, they're going to keep what they've managed to secure for themselves by whatever means necessary. And they will not risk it with something as stupid as a democratic election.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Well, we antagonize the neo-Cohens, as we jokingly call them, and those are nasty people. Those are nasty people.
Yeah.
Yep.
You can't trust a word that comes out of their mouth. Everything is a dagger, you know, pointed at your people's heart.
Well, that's what you'd expect from a bunch of neo-Trotskyites.
Yeah.
Neo-Cohens. I love that term. We use that, too. So.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Well, are we going to have to let you go here, sir?
Well, let me ask y'all one question. You know, I know that I may have met one or all of you before, but you're going to have to tell me if I did.
Well, I go to AMRAN. I have never been to a League of the South event, and that's a failing on my part, but I've never been.
We would love to have you.
I only got in this game like a year ago.
So, okay, that's cool.
And have any of you gentlemen ever met? I've met Brad Griffin, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Brad's a league member.
Mm-hmm.
I have not. I haven't participated or done anything with the league before.
Well, I'd invite y'all to maybe come to a local, maybe a state meeting, or certainly the national conference. We're having it in June the 24th and 25th. We have a building just north of Montgomery here in Alabama. And the reason we have a building is twofold. It's just, first, cool to have a building. And secondly, nobody can put us out of our own building. Mm-hmm. And I know that Jared Taylor, for example, has had trouble with various American Renaissance conferences by having the Antifa folks call the hotel and get them kicked out. So we don't have that problem because we own our own building. We have our national conference there every year.
Well, I'm definitely going to AMRAN. And when was that conference? You said it was June 24th, 25th?
June 24th and 25th, yeah.
And where is it at in Alabama?
It's in a little town called Wetumpka, which is a bedroom community north of Montgomery where all the white folks have gone out to.
Do you make hotel accommodations?
There are hotels in the area there, and Wetumpka and Prattville and various other things. I'll be putting all this information up on the leagueofthesouth.com website here over the next few weeks. But I think one of the speakers that we're going to have this year is going to be Sam Dixon. Do y'all know Sam?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Sam was a founding member of the league, and I think I'm going to try to get Sam to speak to us this year.
Oh, that would be great. I've met him at the last couple of AMRAN conferences. And
he's a good speaker, and he's a good fellow. I've known Sam for a long time.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can get some alt-riders to go down there and start knitting all the resistance together.
We need to do that. We have a lot of young folks in the league, and I think y'all will fit right in, being 25, 36, and 37, I think y'all said you were. You fit right in, and we're a militant bunch, better come with your armor on.
Right. Well, we're the old men. Mankin and I are old men compared to most alt-riders. They're usually college-aged or mid-20s.
That's good to know.
We're
late
30s.
To know that we got young ones coming up like that. Most of our young people are not college students. Most of our young people are out working already. We don't have a lot of young people that are college students in the league.
Well, that's exactly what you need then. You need some alt-riders coming in.
Yeah, we could use some of you folks in the league and use those connections to build some bridges, because there's too few of us to, you know, keep ourselves separated. We need sort of that symbiotic relationship there between groups that'll increase our strength.
Without a doubt.
Yes, sir.
Well, it's not just good for the league. I think it'd be good for the alt-riders, because I was watching a few of your speeches yesterday, and you were reading from Patrick Henry's speech in one of them, the Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death one. And I'm thinking, like, there's a lot of people in the alt-right, you know, they don't know American history, so they turn to, like, you know, obscure European right-wing esoteric literature and stuff. And then none of that's, like, really culturally or ideologically compatible with your average American. And I'm thinking, you know, read some Patrick Henry, you know, read some of your, like, you know, like, your ethnic history. You get the help thing. You get some of our founding fathers were Scotsmen. You know, sure. They carry that with them, that fierce independence. And there was another documentary I saw. It was an old History Channel documentary called The Naked Warriors of Europe. And they go into the kind of, you know, social structure. Even since, you know, the year two, they were fiercely independent people. It's almost like there's some kind of, like, inborn aversion to being, you know, ruled over tyranny. And that's, sure. That's our history. And that's our history, not like, you know, some obscure East European thing, or, you know, we don't need to borrow something from the Japanese. We have it ourselves. It's ours.
Yeah. We have a heritage that goes back. I mean, Tacitus talked about Germanic liberty. I don't want to forget the Norman yoke. You know, my British heritage is part of who I am.
Yeah. Sure. I've got four books here on my desk that I'm looking at right now. One of them is Patrick Henry's paper. The other are the papers of Robert Louis Dabney. One is, I don't know if I can pronounce his first name. It's a French for William. Guillaume or something, Fay, F-A-Y-E, Archaeo-Futurism. Yes, and Julius Evola, Revolt Against the Modern World. So, I read very widely in both.
Well, it's funny, half of those are alt-right titles right off the bat.
Yeah, I know, and I try to keep a foot in both camps.
Well, that's exactly what we need, you know. Macon and I, the old guys are all libertarians, you know.
Yeah.
They were kicked, you know, Tom Woods, DiLorenzo, we know who those guys are, Lou Rockwell. And,
DiLorenzo and Tom Woods were former league members.
I know. Back in the 90s, there was this paleo-libertarian alliance that I would love to recreate, you know, but...
I was a member of the old John Randolph Club back then, and the two fellows who put that paleo conservative and paleo libertarian alliance together were Tom Fleming and Murray Rothbard.
So you've met Murray. I never got to meet Rothbard.
Yeah, I used to talk with Murray. Was a league member at the time he died.
Really?
Yeah, I used to talk with him about twice a week.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's what alt-riders need. They need your experience and your guidance, you know, from the guys that have been fighting this fight forever. You know.
Well, I hadn't been fighting it as long as some people, but I've been in it for quite some time, and I've met a lot of the people in it, and some of them still like me even. I made a lot of enemies too. So.
I'm sure you have. It goes par for the course.
Yep, absolutely. I hope we can do this again.
Oh yeah, this was a great interview. If you had, if you liked it, we're definitely going to do it again.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has just been a great. I mean, it's been like, you know, it's been like sitting here having a friendly phone conversation with a friend. It hadn't been, you know, like an interview or anything like that. It's just been a nice conversation.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we impressed you with, you know, we know a lot of the vocabulary and the issues. And it's good that the alt-right is pretty good about that.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. I have great respect.
Right. Well, thank you, sir. We're going to definitely do this again, and that conference is coming up in June. And to look for the information on that conference on LeagueOfTheSouth.com.
Yeah, LeagueOfTheSouth.com. I think I put up the first post just announcing the conference the other day. I hadn't gotten any speakers up yet, but it's got some other information, so you might want to check out the website for what I've got up there now.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hill. It's been a pleasure, and we're going to put it up, and I'll send you a link to it when we.
Yeah, please do that. Oh, man, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. And let's do it again soon.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you much, sir.
We will.
Thank you very much.
All right, y'all take care, and hey, let's keep moving forward.
We will.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I'm a good old rebel. Now that's just what I am. For this fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fit against it, I only wish we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for anything I've done. I hate the Constitution, this great republic too. I hate the Freedmen's Bureau in uniforms of blue. I hate the nasty eagle with all his brags and fuss. The lying, thieving Yankees, I hate so much. Constructed, and I don't care.